Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
While President Trump feuds with a federal judiciary, Florida's Chief Supreme Court Justice hopes conservatives in the state legislature will dial back attacks on the Florida court system.
And there's another important point I want to make, and that's from the business perspective, from the business community's perspective. It's enormously important to have stability in the court system and to have settled law.
Also this week, the Florida Department of Health faces stiff criticism for its plan to implement new medical marijuana rules under Amendment 2.
Veterans don't need to go through a 90-day waiting period. They should be able to walk into a certifying physician's office with their medical records and in one visit receive their recommendation.
We'll also find out which Florida school district is the first in the state to go completely charter and get the latest on the battle between contractors and insurers when it comes to how many home repairs are handled in Florida. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. During a week when President Donald Trump was tweeting unprecedented personal attacks on federal judges, the Florida courts were coming under some fire of their own. Some conservative House members want to term limit Supreme Court justices, and Chief Justice George LaBarga made a rare public response to the onslaught, as we hear from Jim Ash.
The last time voters revamped the judicial system was 40 years ago, when the Florida Supreme Court was elected and considered a cesspool of bribery, case-fixing, and political cronyism. These days, justices are appointed, and the court is under a much different cloud. Republican critics are blasting rulings on redistricting, the death penalty, and workers' compensation, decisions they call activist and turf meddling. A ballot measure imposing 12-year term limits for appellate judges and Supreme Court justices barely passed a House subcommittee on Thursday. Republican Jennifer Sullivan argued the only check voters have, merit retention votes every 6 years, isn't working because no judge has ever lost.
This bill seeks to correct that and give the people of Florida another opportunity to implement the accountability they originally intended to place upon our judicial branch of government.
Sullivan carefully avoided criticizing the courts. It was a marked contrast from the bitter attacks Republicans made previously when the House passed a similar proposal, only to see it die in the Senate. Chief Justice Jorge LaBarga also avoided criticism earlier this week at a press conference announcing his appointments to the Constitution Revision Commission. When asked about political attacks on the courts, LaBarga says he's not worried.
I'm old enough to remember the billboards that said impeach Warren. You know, the relationship between judiciary and the other two branches has not always been smooth. So this is nothing new. I suspect that throughout our history, we will continue to have disagreements.
That LaBarga would comment at all speaks volumes. Justices are hypersensitive about their objectivity on any matter that could come before the court. But like the legislature, the CRC has the power to put measures directly on the ballot, and judicial term limits could be on the agenda. LaBarga denies giving his appointees a political litmus test, but he said he chose them based on their respect for separation of powers.
My biggest, if I had to ask for an ask, would be the preservation of an independent judiciary to render decisions.
Legal advocates and business groups are pressing hard against judicial term limits. Democratic Representative Sean Shaw of Tampa takes the debate personally. He is the son of late Justice Leander Shaw, Florida's first African-American Chief Justice.
If you do not agree with certain decisions of the Florida Supreme Court or an appellate court, good, that's okay. That means separation of powers is working.
Conservative Republicans aren't the only ones challenging the courts. Freshman Democratic Representative Kimberly Daniels of Jacksonville is railing against the fallout from a 1962 U.S. Supreme Court decision banning prayer in schools. Daniels is a pastor, and despite the case known as Engle, she's filing a bill she hopes will encourage religious expression in public schools.
I don't believe in separation of church and state because the state came out of the church We came to America for religious, our forefathers came to America for religious liberty.
Warren Husband is an attorney for the Florida Bar, which is firmly opposed to judicial term limits. Husband says democracy, like a precision watch, depends on a certain amount of tension between its parts to function properly.
When one branch tries to relieve one of those tensions, it takes the clockwork of our democracy and changes how it functions and maybe makes it so that it doesn't function.
Ballot measures featuring judicial and executive term limits have been attempted in Mississippi, Nevada, and most recently in 2006 in Colorado, Husband says. And voters have rejected them every time. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
The Florida Department of Health spent a week touring the state to get feedback on a draft rule for Amendment 2. Nick Evans reports the department's cautious approach for implementing the medical cannabis initiative is raising the ire of would-be patients.
The Department of Health's Office of Compassionate Use is mulling how to move forward and what changes to make in its proposals for medical cannabis. And the drafters probably have a lot to think about.
You are the Office of Compassionate Use. We are the 71.3%. Hear us roar.
That's Josephine Canella Krell, invoking Amendment 2's support at the polls and voicing a sentiment that resounded throughout the week. In meetings around the state, patients, doctors, and activists have criticized the department's proposed rule. The regulation is a first draft, incorporating the new constitutional provisions within the existing statutory framework. To attorney Stephanie Alexander, that's simply not good enough. She points to a provision tasking the State Board of Medicine with defining debilitating conditions.
I do not believe that since this is a constitutional provision and that the formal rulemaking power has been delegated specifically to the Department of Health, I do not believe that you have the power to redelegate that to the Board of Medicine.
While some commenters raised concerns about the rule's legal foundation, others took issue with its posture. After the vast majority of voters approved a new amendment, a rule offering little to no change seemed like a betrayal. Lauren Drake is a former police officer from Milton, Florida. She's since left the force and advocates for medical cannabis. She held up two photos and asked which person was on illegal drugs.
This person right here, all legally prescribed narcotics, benzos, up to about 15 to 20 different pharmaceuticals. They were all legally obtained for migraines, chronic migraines, and IBS. Picture on the left, this picture was on my left. That's medical marijuana. Both of these pictures are of me.
Bill Cody is a disabled vet. A helicopter crash in Afghanistan broke his back in 2002. And he believes a state-mandated waiting period does a disservice to Florida's service members.
Now, your attempt to dictate the doctor-patient relationship harms veterans. Veterans don't need to go through a 90-day waiting period. They should be able to walk into a certifying physician's office with their medical records and in one visit receive their recommendation.
But the department is in a tricky position. Lawmakers can and probably will step in with legislation that supersedes the department's rule. The problem is the department has a deadline, and it's not clear what the new legal framework will look like. Office of Compassionate Use Director Christian Bax admits it's a challenging proposition.
It's certainly not easy, but we believe that we can fulfill those deadlines. We certainly respect that it's the prerogative of the legislature to pass laws to implement a constitutional amendment. We will respect any legislation that they pass and is signed by the governor and becomes effective.
The department has until early July to complete its rules, slightly less than 60 days after the legislative session concludes. If all goes well, if the proposal doesn't get bogged down in challenges, the department can meet that deadline. But if recent history is any guide, that's unlikely to happen. Regulators have other arrows in the quiver, for instance, a 90-day emergency rule. But if their plans prove contentious, medical cannabis supporters could be in for a long wait. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, property insurance companies say lawsuits from contractors are forcing them to hike rates, but contractors say the insurance companies don't want to pay the claims. Insurers are encouraging lawmakers this year to stop making them pay the contractors' attorneys' fees.
Because I can tell you, if you follow this book and you document that loss 100%, I'm not going to lose that case.
After a tragic incident involving police, an autistic person, and their caregiver, Supporters are happy Florida lawmakers are moving forward on an effort requiring autism training for law officers.
What appears to be a man is really a young child sitting playing with a truck in the middle of the road, and he wouldn't move, and his caregiver was shot.
Some state experts are pushing for more transparency in Florida's community redevelopment agencies.
That long list is preceded by the words, including but not limited to. And so when you put those words in there, you've opened the door to just about anything that they can imagine.
And Floridians don't have to travel to the Everglades to catch a glimpse of mangroves. The tropical trees are now taking root in North Florida, and the ecosystem could be in for drastic change. The battle between Florida's home repair contractors and insurance companies is expected to continue during this year's lawmaking session. Sarah Mueller reports both sides in the fight insist that they are the only ones looking out for homeowners.
This gentleman here, I've got the pictures and all the emails right here. He's the one that lives next to the senator. I'm almost 8 months and haven't got a dime from mitigation.
That's Tallahassee business owner Jeff Grant. He's sitting at his desk at Bone Dry Restoration and Cleaning, a water damage restoration company. He's showing off a stack of paperwork from one of the 10 files on his desk he says are unpaid insurance claims. Grant says if the insurer doesn't pay up soon, he'll file a lawsuit to get paid. But Florida Insurance Commissioner Dave Altmaier says his office is helping push legislation this session that would limit the insurance companies paying the contractors' attorney fees. But contractors and civil law advocacy groups oppose that change. Contractors say the insurers are trying to blame them for the rising rates of property insurance. Many contractors use what's called an assignment of benefits. That means the policyholder or homeowner signs a contract so the vendor can provide a service and bill the insurance company for it. If the insurance company doesn't pay or doesn't pay the entire bill, the vendor takes them to court. If the contractor wins, the insurance company pays the contractor's attorney costs. Barry Gilway of Citizens Property Finance, the state's last resort property insurer, says the statute, also known as the one-way attorney fee statute, was meant to apply just to policyholders, not vendors.
The vendors are simply turning around and they are suing the insurance company, you know, for the total amount of whatever they determine is appropriate in, you know, for a specific claim. The implications of that for a company like Citizens is that it's becoming a massive consumer issue.
Gilway says contractors tell homeowners they can remodel their houses and force the insurance company to pay for it, or they inflate the claims. Citizens says both water damage claims and vendors using AOB contracts are on the rise. Lee Jacobson with Florida Justice Association says he questions Citizens' numbers. He says the insurer's assertion of more water damage claims could easily be explained by causes like the age of the house, not fraud.
The biggest misnomer being used in to argument is that Citizens' data is showing certain trends. Well, Citizens, by its self-prescribed name, is the insurer of last resort, meaning there are insurance companies that won't insure these homes for various reasons, including but not limited to the types of materials that are being used.
Gilway disagrees the claims are due to the age of houses. He says the costs of litigation are the reason it and other insurance companies are raising prices. He says if the attorney fee law doesn't change, companies will leave markets or charge a lot more.
That's simply not going to stop the increase in premiums that we have to charge for the insurance. And I think every private market in Florida would make the same contention. I mean, this is the primary issue that we're facing. There are many other things that we need to do to protect consumers because it's not a fair playing field for the consumers right now.
Jeff Grant, the Tallahassee business owner, says it's the insurance companies who are hurting homeowners by having their preferred vendors cut corners restoring houses. He says there is a book of standards that contractors and insurance adjusters should follow. He says that's why contractors are winning in court.
Because I can tell you, if you follow this book and you document that loss 100%, I'm not going to lose that case.
But Grant says his business won't survive if the insurance companies don't pay the bills and the attorney fee statute is changed. He says he couldn't afford to pay the attorney fees on his own. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
Now, here's a story that at some point may have ramifications for school systems outside of North Florida's Jefferson County, because that county school system will be the state's first charter district at the start of the next school year. Its ongoing failure status has resulted in the district being put through so-called turnaround options. None of them have worked, and three of Jefferson's proposals to turn around its schools have been rejected. In January, State Education Commissioner Pam Stewart gave the county an ultimatum: close down the schools, hire an outside operator to run them, or convert the district into a charter school. Jefferson tried to go with an outside operator, but none in the state have ever worked with a failing district. And in the end, says Jefferson Superintendent Mary Ann Arbelu, the district was left with one choice: convert into a charter.
I was not willing to take the risk of going to the state meeting and walking away from the turn down. That just wasn't what I thought was in our best interest.
The Jefferson School Board voted 4-1 this week to move forward with the charter option. If approved by the state, Jefferson County schools would be the first to be operated by a charter company. Charters operate independently of district boards, which concerns those elected officials, and teachers working at the now consolidated Jefferson Elementary, Middle, and High schools are not guaranteed they're going to keep their job. Jefferson teacher Terry Clark says the district has never followed through on what it says, and she's not confident that's going to happen now.
Here we go again, rushing into something that we're not even sure we can get a charter company to take our school. And I can't wait as a teacher until July for them to tell me I have a job or I don't have a job.
There's a little reservation when Mr. Miller said he's not sure whether we can get someone to come in. And knowing that is the only choice that we have, then that's the only part that I have reservation about.
Shirley Washington sits on Jefferson School Board, and Mr. Miller is Adam Miller, who heads DOE's School Choice Office. Because of the district's failure status, the state wants a charter company with a track record of working with low-income, high-poverty students and failing schools. Jefferson's district of 700 students is the size of a medium-sized elementary school. The Florida Department of Education has offered to help Jefferson with the task and has identified at least three companies that could work, but there's no guarantee they'll want to. Jefferson is a risk. Florida K-12 Chancellor Herschel Lyons says Jefferson is in an uncharted situation, and if no operator can be found,
I don't know what the next step is, but I am focused, along with their school board and with the state board, in ensuring that we provide support in them finding someone.
But there is an incentive. Jefferson is set to go back before the State Board of Education next week. If the board approves the plan, the district will begin seeking a charter school operator, and it could become eligible for an $800,000 grant from the state. If it doesn't, well, no one knows what'll happen in that case. A bill requiring autism awareness training for law enforcement officers is starting to move in both chambers of the Florida legislature. As Sasha Cordner reports, it comes after a high-profile incident that occurred in South Florida last year involving a black man, an autistic man, and law enforcement.
Back in July, the shooting of Charles Kinsey, an unarmed black man in Miami, made national headlines. Why did it receive such attention? Kinsey, a therapist at a group home, was with his autistic patient, Arnaldo Rios. Video shows Kinsey lying on the ground with his hands upraised and talking to law officers. They were responding to calls of a suicide attempt with a gun. Even after Kinsey tries to calm Rios, one officer ends up shooting Kinsey, who still had his hands up.
I still got my hands in there. I said, no, I just got shot. And I'm standing there, so I'm like, sir, why did you shoot me? And his words to me, he said, I don't know.
Before he was shot, Kinsey said he wasn't just worried for himself, he was also concerned about Rios.
I was really more worried about him than myself, because I'm looking at, as long as I got my hands up, they're not going to shoot me. This is what I'm thinking. They're not going to shoot me. Wow, was I wrong?
At the time, the police union representing the officer who shot Kinsey said officers believe Rios was holding a gun, although it was really a toy truck. So the shot was meant for the 23-year-old autistic man. But Matthew Dietz, the lawyer for Rios and his family, said that's wrong.
We didn't mean to shoot the African-American guy. We meant to shoot
the man with a disability is a height of ableism. It makes a person with a disability's life worth nothing. It makes them not even a human.
Almost a week after the shooting, Rios' mother and sister, Miriam and Gladys Soto, said Rios was still traumatized by the incident.
Still wearing the same clothes from...
Con sangre las mangas.
From the accident with Charles' blood.
And now, more than 6 months later, lobbyist Susan Goldstein says Rios' condition is unchanged.
He was cognitively probably around 4 or 5 years old. And he has been in turmoil since.
As the mother of an autistic daughter, she says it's important law enforcement be trained to recognize the condition.
These children with autism do not wear physically their disability as many other disabilities or developmental disabilities are recognizable immediately.
That's why she supports a bill by Democrats Dania Beach Representative Evan Jenny and Fort Lauderdale Senator Perry Thurston. Thurston says his bill will have a positive effect on the way law enforcement interact with many Florida children. The CDC estimates 1 in 68 kids are diagnosed with autism.
And what this bill does is it requires the Department of Law Enforcement to establish a constant employment training component relating to autism spectrum disorder.
Both the House and Senate bills recently unanimously passed their first committees. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
CRAs, or Community Redevelopment Agencies, can be a little mystifying. What are they? And where do they get their money? Regan McCarthy reports lawmakers have found themselves asking many of those same questions and are now asking another, shouldn't CRAs be a little more transparent?
The city of Tallahassee has two CRAs, the Frenchtown Southside Community Redevelopment Area and the Downtown District Community Redevelopment Area. And while the goals of the program seem laudable, to reduce blight and improve the local economy, some question whether the projects the CRA has funded are doing that. During a recent community conversation on the issue, Skip Foster, the publisher of the Tallahassee Democrat, pushed Leon County Commissioner Marianne Lindley on the issue.
The downtown Walgreens closing recently made some headlines. My question for you is, isn't this kind of everything wrong with economic development? And isn't this an example of the kind of stuff happening in that a lot of legislators are criticizing as corporate welfare run amok?
Oh, you mean the putting of community redevelopment money into that corner? Well, I don't think so. I mean, that was most lately before the building, it was an abandoned gas station.
Lindley says in this case, she believes the lawmakers are wrong. But in the same week, Ted Sauerbeck from the Florida Auditor General's office told a panel of House members CRAs aren't getting the oversight they need. Sauerbeck says his office has conducted 24 CRA audits in the past 10 years.
And because there are a number of findings that we have consistently noted for those audits, we decided as part of this performance audit to take a look at the laws that govern CRAs and see if there was an opportunity to improve accountability.
Sauerbeck says one concern is that the language specifying how CRA money can be spent is too broad.
Section 163.387.6 provides a long list of authorized purposes for CRA expenditures. But the problem is that long list is preceded by the words including but not limited to. And so when you put those words in there, you've opened the door to just about anything that they can imagine.
Sauerbeck is recommending a legislative change that specifies exactly how CRA money can be used rather than leaving room for interpretation. He says that could help the public, lawmakers, and Sauerbeck's office check into an agency's spending. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, mangroves are quintessentially tropical, home to colorful fish and crabs spouting along the coast of the Everglades and the Keys. But these plants are not marooned in South Florida anymore. Kate Payne went searching for mangroves along the state's Gulf Coast.
Historically, scientists believe mangroves didn't live farther north than Cedar Key in the middle of Florida's Big Bend. But that's not the case anymore. I went exploring with a scientist named Caitlin Snyder, who's based in Apalachicola.
Like I mentioned, not many trees can really deal with this type of environment of such high salinities and changing either from storms and tides.
We hiked into a place called East Hole, 80 miles south of Tallahassee. There's a little spit of beach flowing into a winding series of shallow tide pools edged with marsh grasses. Snyder has done some monitoring here before.
I'll take note of any leaf damage, whether the tips are black, say from a freeze event, whether there's any insect damage, just kind of like the overall condition that I see of the mangrove.
And there they are.
Mangrove. That's a red one.
Jutting out of the olive-green blanket of salt marsh is a red mangrove. Maybe 2 feet tall, these aren't extensive forests like in South Florida, but individual trees scattered in the grass.
I just can't get over, like, you just see them everywhere.
Yeah.
And they stand out so much against the grass.
They do. They're a really vivid green.
And even though these plants are in a strange new habitat, they're vibrant and healthy. There are many factors that determine where a mangrove will take root, but they're ultimately at the mercy of hard freezes.
Be they mangroves, be they invasive plants, invasive species, any tropical organism, these freeze events play a really important role in setting the northern limit of those species.
That's research ecologist Michael Osland with the U.S. Geological Survey. He's watching the mangrove migration all across the Gulf Coast, where there haven't been many hard freezes lately.
And so as climate changes, we get a shift in the frequency intensity of those events. It's going to allow those tropical species to move northward. And small changes in air temperatures can trigger these really dramatic, what we call ecological regime shifts.
Ecological regime shift. Sounds scary, right? Marsh grasses and mangroves are both really beneficial, and they're both foundational species, meaning everything else in the ecosystem revolves around them. So when one of those bedrock species is replaced by another, it could spell chaos. But Osland says it's too soon to know if the change will be good or bad.
In other areas, mangrove expansion to salt marsh could be beneficial in terms of increased carbon storage or wave attenuation. But that said, there will be some pretty big shifts for the habitat that these systems support.
But Osland says as the effects of climate change intensify, mangroves will continue to replace salt marshes along the Gulf Coast. To be clear, mangroves are not taking over the panhandle yet. But Caitlin Snyder says they're here to stay.
I think we're kind of at that tipping point of where freeze events can still knock them back, but I think they're here.
And the question is, where will the mangroves show up next? And what will survive under the new regime? For WFSU News, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FBRCapReport, and please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.